being a banker for 21 years almost.
That's okay. It's going to fuel you. It's still, I think, fueling me to this day.
Somebody that's a little bit bored should be waiting a long time. So people are just going to have to roll up their sleeves.
Try to make sense of it because there's so much information coming in and you don't know what's relevant and what's not.
The corporate world for 4 years as a CEO.
I'm not interested in having this small probability of losing a whole lot of money.
You need to be surrounded by other smart people.
Got me through the door because it's a pretty small group and it's
Hello, everyone. This is your host, Maura Maya. Welcome to another episode of the Finance Podcast, where I explore the professional journey of individuals who have successfully built careers in the financial industry. This episode is particularly interesting as we will be talking about COVID-19 and its effect on markets and how this will all play out. My guest this week is Jonathan Ennis. John joined McKenzie Investments in 2008, working in the portfolio operations department before joining the fixed income team in 2010 as an associate investment analyst. He has developed research coverage across a range of sectors, such as real estate, utilities, infrastructure, home builders, building products, forestry and paper, printing and publishing, healthcare and pharma, aerospace and defense, and airlines. He has also helped to expand the credit research geographic footprint from North America to include Europe and emerging markets, and is also responsible for ESG integration across all corporate debt holdings. John has a Bachelor of Commerce degree and an MBA from the Smith School of Business at Queen's University. He is also a CFA chart holder. So please enjoy my conversation with Jonathan Ennis. Hi, John. Thank you for being with us here today on the platform. Such a pleasure to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I just want to say it's a really great idea. I've had a lot of like coffee chats with students and always thought there's got to be a better way to scale, like in a podcast format, so lots of people could hear all the stories. So
yes, exactly. Thank you. So before we get into understanding your day-to-day role as an analyst for McKenzie Investments, I would like to discuss your story. How does it all start?
Sure. Well, my story starts in a small town, Eastern Ontario. So it's about half an hour, 50K maybe, south of Ottawa. I grew up on a dairy farm, which, you know, is a good place to learn about hard work and perseverance. And for me, I decided to apply that into running because I lived on kind of a 5 kilometer block running around the dirt road. So I got into that. And then I also got into finance and investing because when you grow up on a farm, you start working at a young age. And fortunately for myself and my brothers, we got paid for working at a young age, so we saved a bunch of money, and then I started to get interested in what do I do with this money and how do I invest it to make it grow. So I took that kind of early interest and went down the road about an hour and a half to Kingston for Queen's Commerce. And then after university, I found a job in Ottawa for 2 years, actually in the airline and tour operator space. And after that, quit that job and followed a girl. She was my fiance at the time, now my wife. And so followed her to Toronto and then kind of started over again, picked up that interest in finance and investing, started looking for jobs in Toronto, started off at McKenzie Investments. And then here we are kind of 12 years later into that career.
Amazing. So it did work out following moving all the way to Toronto. I want to change a little bit and ask this next question. What are some of the biggest challenges you've encountered throughout your career and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, when I think back, the biggest challenges, like I think the career transitions are very challenging for everybody. So when I think of biggest challenges, I think of graduating university without kind of a job lined up. And so making that transition from university into that first job, which was in the travel business. And then a couple of years later, like I mentioned, making that transition from one sector, from travel into finance and investing. And so those are both challenging times. And I think, overcoming it, you know, so that's an important part of that was transition. So like I said, she was the girlfriend and then she was the fiance and then she was the wife, but making those transitions together, and also for her as she's made her career transition, supporting her.
Mm-hmm. Following that idea of change, challenges, and transitions, I think one of the most important transitions currently for some of our audience is taking that step from finishing graduating university to getting that first job in finance. And my question is, given the deep recession that we've encountered and the rapid recovery, what is the best advice that you can give students who are graduating in 2020, 2021, who are going to be entering this labor market?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some general advice about trying to get that first job. But yeah, it is interesting. I mean, we haven't had a recession in a while. And so it's graduating into 2020, 2021, it might look a bit different. From what we haven't seen, at least in finance, we haven't seen like a big drop in the amount of jobs that are available, or a large amount of layoffs. And like specifically at our company, there's nothing this year. And so I think it kind of depends how long the recession lasts before there's more decisions made around layoffs and the jobs that are available. For us, I mean, we've had some rotational programs running for the past 5 years. And so that was started 2014, 2015 timeline. And the number of positions through those programs has kind of grown year by year, and then they're you know, holding steady for this year. So I guess we haven't seen it yet, but it'll kind of depend how long the recession lasts.
I'd like to change the line of questioning a little bit, and I'm very curious, and I want to talk about the current asset market environment in which we find ourselves. Interest rates are really low, and that leads me to ask, yields from fixed income instruments seem unattractive for investors right now. Where should they be putting their money?
Yeah, great. Yields, I mean, they've pretty much been straight down like my entire life. That's a pretty long bull market for bonds. Interest rates have been one direction, and looking at like Government Canada 10-year bonds. So like when I started university, it was like 6%. And then that was, you know, 2001, when I started on the fixed income team back in 2010, it was kind of a 3%. And now we're like a half of 1% Government of Canada 10-year bond. And so that's where we're at. But the work that I do, like I'm leading the credit analyst group on the Mackenzie fixed income team. And the team overall manages about $45 billion of assets out of the $135 billion that Mackenzie manages. So it's about a third of the total. And so within that $45 billion, it's a mix of government debt and corporate debt. And I spend every day looking at corporate debt, same as our analyst group. And so we're really looking at where are all the opportunities for that extra yield to pick up with corporates versus governments. And so that gets us into high quality, like investment grade corporates, but it's also high yield issuers and loan issuers and emerging market debt. So all of those things takes you from like a low single digit yield to like a mid single digit yield and kind of expected return. So that's a lot of the work that we put into it, is to deliver, call it in a lot of our funds, mid single digit, you know, returns at a time when interest rates are near zero, at least for government debt. So that's why it's an important area and why we keep adding more credit analysts to that group.
So my question is along the same lines. And again, with low interest rates, this provides an environment filled with opportunities for companies to take on more debt. And my question is, are we at a dangerous time where companies are highly leveraged or highly leveraging themselves in an environment that hasn't yet fully recovered, where unemployment remains high and volatility is quite present? So should investors be worried by this debt that companies are taking on?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of debt issuance. I mean, we've been focused on the corporate side, like I said, but governments are taking on massive amounts of debt. So all the government, you know, debt to GDP numbers are going straight up with all the deficits that are happening. So yeah, I'll see what the long-term implications are that. But for the corporate debt, we've been focused on it. I mean, there was a lot of opportunities in kind of March, April, May, because the name of the game was liquidity, because with the economy shut down and not sure how long that was going to last, companies were raising as much cash as they could, even if they had to pay a high interest rates, like we saw cruise lines and airlines issuing secured debt, 10, 11, 12%. So there was, it's kind of extreme, but there's lots of opportunities during that time period for investors. But going forward, I mean, these companies are going to be coming out the other side of the recession with more debt. So it's requires kind of careful monitoring of how much debt they can sustain and looking at the credit metrics in terms of like the interest coverage ratios and the leverage ratios to see how much debt they're able. Right now, they're just trying to put as much cash on the balance sheet as possible so that if they are burning cash on a regular basis right now, they have that liquidity buffer. But longer term, we have to assess the capital structure.
Yeah, so I know that you said you were talking about holding a lot of government debt as well. And there's a lot of voices on Wall Street talking about yield curve control. What does that mean to you? Do you agree with this? Will we see it? Has quantitative easing been enough? We know that governments have huge budget deficits. Is there a fear that too much debt is just not good?
When I hear yield curve and kind of outlook for interest rates, I want to defer to my colleagues, and I can actually recommend McKenzie's had a pretty good run of on their podcast. There's 17 episodes on the McKenzie Investments podcast featuring a lot of portfolio managers, including three of my colleagues. So our team lead, Steve Locke, our global portfolio manager, Constantine Bomer, and our chief fixed income strategist, Dustin Reed. And so they'll have a more informed view on kind of the Fed and central banks and quantitative easing and what it means for yield curves and all that kind of thing. So I don't want to say too much in that area as focused on corporate debt, but the rating agencies will have a view, and we're starting to see that, like for sovereigns. Like I think Canada lost one of its AAA ratings by Fitch, I believe. So it's the rating agencies will have a say in terms of how much debt is too much debt for governments as well as for corporates, and we pay more attention to that on the corporate side. And on the corporate side, we're focused on making sure we get compensated for that level of debt and that level of risk and whatever that credit rating may be. Mm-hmm.
Great. And my last question regarding fixed income is interest rates. Yields remain low, we talked about this, but where do you see the demand for fixed income instruments going while interest rates remain relatively low?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of it is driven by demographics. So, I mean, the baby boomers are kind of 55 to 75, and there's, a rule of thumb, kind of an old rule of thumb out there that you should own your age in fixed income. Maybe you can update that rule of thumb that you own your age in fixed income and maybe some alternatives like real estate and infrastructure and private equity, those kind of categories. But you do need something to lessen the equity market volatility as you get older and as you're trying to hold on to your assets for a long retirement. So a lot of the demand for fixed income, I would say, simply is kind of in that baby boomer demographic where you might be half in equity and half in fixed income, and you might run with that mix through a good portion of your retirement. So I think that's where a lot of the demand is.
John, I know you're fixed income, but I do have to ask, are investors being forced into risky equity markets right now? We know the saying, don't fight the Fed. So where should I be putting my money? Should I be bullish in this environment? Is investing in the risky equity markets right now the only way I can make some decent returns?
Yeah, there is a no alternative, a view for the equity market that everything else, the yields are so low for everything else that you have to own equities. So, it gets a bit dangerous back to that thinking on the equity market because valuations can only go so far. I think it's been a little surprising to us on the equity markets and as well on the credit markets to the extent that it's bounced back to kind of generally where we were at the beginning of the year. Whereas, I'm not an economist or a strategist, but the economic outlook is not great, and it's quite a bit worse than it was at the beginning of the year. So it's been a bit surprising for us. We were generally positioned a bit cautious going into the year, anticipating more of a general recession, just in that it had been 12 years since the last recession, not necessarily a pandemic-induced lockdown recession. And so this is a bit new to predict how long the recession is, but we're still a bit cautious given you know, the sharp severity of downturn in Q2 and then the lingering effects of the shutdown.
So I do want to, one final question regarding markets, because I think we took this into a different direction. And it's a great segue. And there was an opinion piece on Bloomberg talking about bears in the market becoming extinct. So I want to ask, should I be bullish in this environment as the majority of Wall Street has been or seems to be?
Right. I've read some stuff. I was doing some research on shorting equity, on shorting credit, and some of the commentators in that space have said that the number of people who have been outright short the market has kept declining every year, just as you've had this bull market 30 years kind of thing. So it does kind of force you into being bullish. You're asking a credit analyst and a fixed income team if it should be bullish on the equity markets. You might get a different answer from an equity analyst and from an equity team, of which there are many at McKinsey, where, you know, multi-boutique, 14 different investment teams, of which we're one of them, but lots of equity teams as well. One thing that I'm kind of stuck on is that looking at the charts of the stock market charts over the last 100 years, every time there's a major correction, there's typically a retracement of 50% or so, and then it drops to a lower low before starting into a bull market. And we haven't seen that because we had the sharp crash like in March, and then you've retraced like 100%, like I said, to kind of where you were at the beginning of the year. And so maybe this time is different versus the previous 100 years of market crashes, but we're still a bit cautious for that other shoe to drop of markets being both equity and credit being overly optimistic about, you know, the outlook for 2021, for 2022, 2023. I mean, I'm coming at it from a bottom-up perspective, but we see, you know, we look at COVID impact on all of our sectors and put them in buckets of low, medium, and high impact. So those low impact sectors like technology, telecom, healthcare, 2021 will be better than 2019. They just kind of grow right through it. But there's a lot of medium and high impact sectors where 21 will be lower than 19, and even 22 will be lower than 19 for some sectors like airlines and hotel, leisure, and all things.
Yes.
So you can put us down as cautious in terms of.
The reason I was asking is because I know that when interest rates are low, this fuels the equity market. So, because there's less to be made on fixed income, so low interest rates tends to come with a fueling of securities in the equities market.
It'll be interesting to see. Like, I'm starting to hear some companies talk about, just because everybody's talking about how low interest rates are, I'm hearing companies talk about it being like, it's so low, like the coupons, especially some of the large corporates that are paying 2% interest rates on their bonds, and there's going to be pressure for them to issue more bonds, because if you can issue debt at 2% and then buy back shares or do anything with that money, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on CEOs and CFOs to, you know, maintain or even increase their debt level just because the expectation of interest rates. And in a lot of cases, they have those interest rates locked in for 10 years if they issue a 10-year bond and they have that 2% coupon locked in. I think we're kind of macro, we're in the camp, a lot of people with lower for longer for interest rates, which, you know, will be good for corporates if they can borrow at these low levels. But it kind of remains to be seen what that optimal leverage looks like for companies. Yeah. I heard a company talking the other day, like back in the day, they were paying 7% for the debt and then 5%. Now they're paying 2% for their debt. And so with that lower cost of debt, the optimal leverage and capital structure is probably going to change. So I think it's something we're going to have to live with, this higher level of debt.
I think it's time to move into a different line of questioning. This next segment really focuses on advice. It is more of a mentorship and guidance for our audience. What are some of the tools and or habits that you utilize on the daily to achieve the level of performance you need to excel in your field?
The daily, yeah, I think it depends on the person. Like, I'm a morning person. My wife's a night person. So, I mean, I think you kind of work your day a little bit around around when you work best, you know, in this work remote, work from home environment, you've got more flexibility. Where you can work at 4 in the morning if you want, and then you're done whenever, or you can work till midnight. I mean, also you can do that in university, right? Like, I think those patterns that you figure out in university, what works best time of day, I think you can apply some of that in the workforce, and likely there'll be more flexibility in the workforce going forward. So there's that. I think like exercise is a big deal, I think, for a lot of people. That the hard part is scheduling it. And I think back in when we were working in the office, like lunchtime, going out for a run or going to the gym was helpful to break up the day and give you the energy boost. And also just to get away from your desk, like if you've been working on something at your desk and then you can go for a walk or a run or work out, then you can reflect on all that work and kind of come to decisions and recommendations rather than just sitting at one spot. I found that, I mean, through university, I found like when I was running well, like my grades were better, and when it's not, my grades were worse. And you see that in the professional space as well.
Yes, a lot of people recommending taking some time to do some exercise, very beneficial. My next question is, what is the best advice you can give someone graduating university?
Yeah, I think a general piece of advice is that, like, think about the skill sets that you're developing at university and how that might apply to multiple careers. I mean, there's a lot of focus, rightly so, on that first job and that first career, but just kind of, you know, pursue your interests, collect the education, the experience to do that university career. But just keep in mind that you might have, your career might be in 5-year blocks or 10-year blocks, and it might all be in the same sector or it might be different sectors. You know, a good chance it'll be at different companies. So just keep that in mind as you're thinking about the future.
I was reading, and I think this is a really interesting question that fits well with the one I just asked. When you are in an interview with a candidate, what impresses you most? Because I read that on the file that I received, and I thought it was a great question.
Yeah, it's a good question. There's interviews coming up, September, October kind of season. And yeah, I think generally I say that the initiative stands out. And I've talked to a lot of students in the past saying that, you know, if you can do put together a bit of a portfolio of your work, like if you're looking for a credit analyst job and write some credit reports and equity analyst equity reports, that kind of thing, because there's nothing, typically the people who are interviewing, there's nothing they like talking about more than, you know, if they're in the investing and sort of talk about a company, a sector, then they kind of light up and you can ask them back and forth. And it's more, you know, just looking at what the process is and what their thought process is and how they, you know, present a recommendation rather than the actual content. It's just, you know, showing that initiative and engaging that conversation. It does stand out, you know, if there's a list of candidates that are kind of equally qualified.
So my next question is, to what skill and or do you attribute most of your success?
Yeah, it's probably a bit cliche, but just back to the kind of growing up on a farm and the perseverance of, you know, back then you had to kind of work every day. And so that you kind of got that training. And so you can apply that to anything that you want to. And so kind of the perseverance and the grinding it out, that's, you know, worked well for in different areas, you know, from sports to school to work. So that's one. There is an element of skill and luck. Like when we look at, you know, performance attribution for investing, we find that, you know, on a shorter time period, it's hard to differentiate from skill from luck. Like, did you outperform on purpose or by accident?
Yeah. Basically?
But what you can see is if you're looking at numbers, if you get into a 3-year, 5-year track record for a fund against peers, against benchmark, then you start to, you can start to identify investing, you know, skill, and then you figure out where that came from, if it's asset allocation decisions or sector selection or security selection. So I think there's some of that in your career development as well, where it's a combination of skill and luck, but over longer time periods, the skill kind of comes out.
Yes. And so my last question before we get into closing remarks is, are there any resources, perhaps books to which you would direct someone because it had some sort of impact on you?
Yeah, books. I've carried books around a lot of different apartments and houses. I mean, you collect a lot of them through high school, university, and then you keep collecting them afterwards, but the rate of collecting slows down. So I would think, we're reorganizing the house back to school right now. So I think in terms of like shelves of books, so I think there's like a, for me, in my interest, there's a shelf or two about history and politics. And I think it's more over the centuries and decades, the longer view. And then there's a shelf on like business stories. Like read a couple books on Uber recently and Disney and Nike and just those kind of books that come out are interesting. Finance books you would have had already. And then there's a bunch of strategy and leadership books that got accumulated kind of through the MBA time period. So I would think in different shelves. There's one book in particular that would be helpful for a good chunk of the audience. It's a book called Quiet, and it's the subtitle is by Susan Cain. It's the Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And so it's a lot of good examples of, there's actually a lot of investors are introverts. They're just kind of like to study their field. But also on leadership, there's kind of fewer case studies that are evident of leaders who are introverts, because a lot of the leaders we think of are more extroverted. For maybe a third of the population, that might be a helpful read. The other thing I'd say is that podcasts are great, like, yours, and to ask folks for recommendations for podcasts, because it's a lot easier to consume, while you're doing your work. Versus reading a book, which you might not have the time to carve out. So like I said, Mackenzie has one, which is fairly new, which is great. Bloomberg has one, Masters in Business, which is a good for a student audience as well, where they have lots of interesting, economists and investors and those sorts show up on that podcast.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So is there anything else you'd like to suggest or mention as we wrap up? Any advice for our audience?
Just reiterate a couple things on the, for the university experience, collecting a bunch of, following your interests, collecting a bunch of education and experiences that could apply to multiple careers. I think reaching out to like alumni and having these kind of conversations is helpful. I didn't do any of that kind of in fourth year. And I think that's something that's helpful, like for research. So students can get an idea of what's the day in the life of and what might fit their interests. Any kind of searching you can do on a database. I did that because I was interested in travel. And so I was looking up airlines and hotels and tour operators. And so I was able to actually get my first job, like going that route. So I think that's helpful. What else? I think that's pretty much it.
John, thank you for a fantastic conversation. It has been a pleasure to have you on the platform.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That was my conversation with John Ennis at Mackenzie Investments. I really hope you guys enjoyed it. Remember, this podcast is brought to you by the McGill Investment Club. First things first, Mackenzie currently has openings for these amazing rotational programs based out of Toronto. The due date for applications is September 21st. So make sure that if you're interested in working at Mackenzie Investments in a rotational program as an internship, you check them out. You can find the information through the McGill Investment Club website or signing up to the McGill Investment Club newsletter. I cannot stress this enough that if you are interested in finance, I recommend, strongly recommend that you sign up to the McGill Investment Club newsletter. This is a fantastic newsletter that they release every week with tons of resources for students interested in finance. They have an amazing selection of reading topics in terms of what has occurred in financial markets or news. They also release job postings on this newsletter. If you are looking for an internship and you don't know where to go, this newsletter is your holy grail. They have great job postings. I definitely recommend. That's it for now. I really hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Remember to stay safe.